Just a quick warning about today's episode. It contains frank discussions about things that go on in the temple. So if you are sensitive to such things, please skip over this episode and catch me next week. Thanks.
My heart has no words. My eyes have no tears left. Mind it done gone crazy. Went off and married my fears. Now I'm standing here with nothing left to tell you. I'm standing here with nothing to prove. I got nothing to prove.
Hello, everybody. Welcome to Mormon Expression Voices. This is Heather, and today I am in John and Zilpha's studio to do a very special interview with somebody who many of you probably know from online. We're going to call her Insana D, because that is how she's known by most of the ex-Mormon world, and because at this time in her life, she still likes to protect her privacy, and hey, I totally understand that. So welcome, Insana D, for your interview for Voices.
Thank you, Heather. I'm so excited to be here and finally connect. We've kind of missed each other over the months, but
over and over again.
I'm here and ready to go.
Good. Okay. So why don't we go ahead and just start right in how we usually do on Voices.
Okay.
And talk about your origins with Mormonism. Did you grow up in the church?
I did. True blue Mormon all the way. Probably, I don't know, fourth generation maybe.
Okay. And you grew up in Oregon, did I hear?
I was born in Idaho on the way to Oregon, and then I lived in Oregon till I was 12.
Okay. And what was your Mormon childhood like?
The Mormon part was good. The Mormon part was good. It was pretty traumatic as a child, just because we had a kind of a rough family experience. And my dad was LDS, but you know, a Jack Mormon most of his life. And he was a well-known abuser, not sexual, but just beat the living crap out of us all the time.
Right. And you have a blog that we should probably tell people about. Remind me what the name of it is again.
I've got one called Finding the Pony, and it's about finding the optimism in the pile of, you know what, that life tends to give you.
Mm-hmm.
And that might be my opus for Mormonism. And it chronicles my life and some essays type things that are just my musings or whatever. And experiences it mostly all in Mormonism. Mm-hmm. And then I have one called Core Whores Double D's. And that's irreverent, naughty stuff. You shouldn't read that. And then I have an art blog and I have a gardening blog.
Okay.
And, the Core Whores Double D's, so you don't go look at it because it's naughty and it's inappropriate, is spelled KoriWhores Double D's. And it seems to come up on weird porn searches. So I get some weird, because
referrals.
People are apparently looking for double D's, but they're disappointed when all they find is just irreverent Mormon jokes.
Right.
So don't look at that.
But on the Find the Pony blog, you talk about your childhood. And
I do.
And the difficulties that your family went through and how your mother responded to it, which I find incredibly fascinating. And at some point I want to do a podcast just about women and how they respond to their celestial how eternity affects them and the decisions they make in response to their families and what they think they need to do to be a good Mormon woman. I find some of those things fascinating. So your childhood was rough, but you enjoyed Mormonism.
I did. The Mormonism of the 70s doesn't resemble present day Mormonism, and it was a different world, and it was a place that was quite supportive, even of weird people like myself in the 70s. But by mid 80s it was becoming extremely rigid, and by the 90s it was suffocating.
Mm-hmm. So it was kind of like a fun cultural thing, right?
Yeah, where lots of activities. I didn't care that much about the doctrine. I was there Mm-hmm. I was there for the food. Okay. Yeah, Jell-O.
And how about your teenage years? Did they, did you basically stay in line with the church? Did you have any doubt?
No. I was one of those kids that never obeyed the rules, never. I ran with scissors, you know.
Okay.
I got ends on my report card, needs improvement, you know. Mm-hmm. And it wasn't because I wasn't smart. I just was bored. And extremely ADD. And so only back then they just called us misbehaving or whatever. You know, we sat in the corner a lot.
Right.
But mostly I was bored at church, even when I was a little girl, when it was the rigid portions of church. But as far as social, you know, I'm like a cocker spaniel. I'll go anywhere and do anything just to mm-hmm. have fun with people.
Okay. And how did you feel about the young women's program that when you were growing up, did you balk at the feminine teachings or?
It was a joke. It was one of those things because I had five brothers mm-hmm. And they got the cool scout stuff, and all the money that if we had even a penny was spent on the boys, and us girls were servants of the boys, and that was the way it was, and that was the way they learned to deal with women, and the way women, you know, women are their own worst enemy in Mormonism.
And did you chafe against that, or did you just kind of go with it?
Oh, I did a poor job just so I wouldn't get asked again. I would put eggshells in the coffee grounds when I'd make coffee for my dad, even though he was, you know, mm-hmm, he was LDS, mm-hmm. but Jack Mormon. I would, and not necessarily purposely, I just didn't pay attention mm-hmm. because I didn't care about that kind of stuff. I've since become a pretty good cook and a good homemaker, but I, when it was required of me, then I would resist.
Okay. All right.
I don't follow recipes.
Right.
Yeah. I wing it.
Okay. So tell me about your transition into adulthood. I know that you had a bit of a rough start into your adulthood, right?
I don't know that I've reached adulthood emotionally, yeah.
But how old were you when you got married?
I was a dumb young 19-year-old.
That's
very,
what I thought.
Very dumb.
And why don't you share your story about your wedding and why you got married and how, and your interactions with your mother-in-law and all of those types of things that happened in that time period.
Okay. I got married because I was pregnant. That was the big deal. And that's just what you did. If you got pregnant, you married. And my ex-husband, I think, really was in love with me, but I was not in love with him. And I was kind of a lamb to the slaughter. Well, this is the mess I made of my life. And I was kind of on the rebound. A young man had dumped me and I was in love with him and I wasn't quite good enough for his royal family. And, you know, in retrospect, I can see that it would have been, you know, gasoline on a fire. But, for me, it was devastating because it was kind of my ticket out of poverty and my ticket out of being, you know, unseen. Mm-hmm. And so when I met my ex-husband and he was so attentive and everything, I kind of assumed, well, he'll, you know, he won't abuse me. He won't leave me. So this must be what is my destiny. And so I got married in the bishop's office. And we were told the typical things that they tell couples in the early 80s, you know, no oral sex, don't, you know, none of the good stuff. And we didn't have a good intimate life at all. And so I either thought something was wrong with me or I thought that sex itself was pretty boring.
So he was LDS.
He converted on my behalf and kind of hook, line, and sinker. And I could have been a Hare Krishna and he would have
followed
in.
You. So was he LDS when you guys got married then?
Yeah, he had been baptized by for about 5 months.
At that point?
4 or 5 months, yeah.
Okay. When you got married civilly in your bishop's office, it was probably not a very joyful occasion.
No, I wore a prom dress. It was kind of a, Mom, we're getting married next weekend. And it was mostly just because I was starting to have morning sickness and I thought I better do this because short, plump women tend to show real quick. And, mm-hmm. and I thought I better do this while I can still fit in a dress. Mm-hmm. And My mom, for years, she kept doing the math, and this is how sweet she is. She just kept thinking he was a really healthy 8-pound preemie.
Oh, so nobody knew but you.
It was kind of obvious in my book, but nobody
there was
that
no formal conversation
knew.
Okay, okay. So then when you got married at 19, did you, during that ceremony at that time, were you thinking, we will definitely go to the temple?
I just assumed that that was the next step. It was kind of what you do. You're kind of on this treadmill or this bucket list, and you, if you're born a girl, if your list has been laid out, and same for boys, and you learn to tat and fold pretty napkins for dinner, and then you get married as soon as you're, you know, eligible, uh-huh. and squeeze off a bunch of babies, and then, you know, you dedicate your life to the church, and you become like everybody else, and it's laid out. It's you don't think about it because it's already there.
So were you automatically starting on the 1-year path?
Yeah. And it was kind of like, I knew I wasn't happy in my marriage. In fact, that first year was horrific, and I was still of that naive mindset that the temple would fix it. Mm-hmm. Because that's what we were taught, that, you know, as long as you get married in the temple, everything else is okay. But, you know, it was like starting with a really bad foundation underneath a, you know, an equally crappy house, and the foundation falls apart and the crappy house can't withstand it either.
Right. Well, and you didn't have the easiest start. You were young.
Yeah.
And it wasn't the best match. And you had a baby that had problems, right?
That was later. The first baby is my son, and he's absolutely perfect.
Okay. I thought when you went to the temple, you had a baby that was...
Oh, no. He just puked on the temple leader.
Okay.
But that, I don't consider that a flaw.
Oh, no. For some reason, last time I talked to you, I thought that he was having, like, when he was a baby, he had a vomit problem or something.
Well, the little muscle that goes around the esophagus mm-hmm. Didn't close tight when mm-hmm. he was first born. And so he would had projectile vomiting. And so I'd feed him, and if you disturbed him even a little bit before that food kind of worked its way down, he could shoot it across the room. Mm-hmm. And it was entertaining at times, but mostly just embarrassing. But he puked all over the temple president when he went to lift him up.
You didn't. For some reason, I had this notion in my head that he was a sickly baby, but I guess not.
Yeah, no, he wasn't sickly, but I did have a baby later that passed away.
Oh, okay. So your first year of marriage, you have this baby, you're on the path to going to the temple. Mm-hmm. Are you active in the church, have callings?
Very, very, yeah. I was hook, line, and sinker. Not that I believed it so much, but it was what you do, you know, and it's all I knew. And I was a good Mormon as far as the soldier, you know. I was mm-hmm. ready to pick up the pack no matter how heavy it was and mm-hmm. whatever calling. And I, when my first two kids were fairly little, we were pretty broke mm-hmm. and living in California, which was really expensive for us. And so I was doing daycare out of our 2-bedroom apartment to make ends meet. And so I had little kids around all day, every day, and I was so tired of kids. And I worked part-time at night at a pick and save. So I had 2 jobs and daycare, and I'd have to be up at 5 a.m. for that. And then they called me to be nursery leader. And I thought, who the hell does this to a woman? And they just kind of assumed that that's, you know, I must just love kids mm-hmm, because, mm-hmm. you know, I do daycare all day long and work nights. So I must really, really want to do it all again on Sunday. And I did a good job. I was a really good nursery leader. Mm-hmm. But, you know, you just say yes because
it's what you were supposed to do.
Yeah. And I come from a long line of, you know, just the pack mules of Mormonism that will, mm-hmm. no matter what crappy job that's, they call us.
Right.
We're the janitors for Mormonism.
Okay. And so you said you didn't really believe it, but did you spend time worrying about it, or
when you're a young mommy and you've got all that going, you don't really, you know, I think contemplation is a luxury. It's a luxury of time or a luxury of space, you know, and I had no time to put 2 and 2 together. I knew it didn't make sense. And even from the time I was a little girl, I, you know, would run across just glaring inconsistencies that even with as little education as I had, just didn't make sense. And I would just, like they say, put it on a shelf. But mostly I was in it for the social aspects, and it was good for my young family. And, and as much as I might blast the church for a lot of things, my kids turned out incredible. So I think it's good parenting, but also the church helped in the socialization of that.
Okay. So let's talk about when you guys did go to the temple. You'd been married a year, and you had a rather unique and not good temple experience when you got your endowment out for the first time.
It was horrific.
Had you taken prep classes?
We did. We took the whole, you know, everything they offered, which was, you know, it's like studying the stars and the lunar cycles for astrology and telling your fortune or whatever to become a NASA scientist. And it had absolutely nothing to do with what we actually did in
ended
the temple.
Up doing
it was
in
such
the temple.
Baloney. Okay. And I resented that because they did not prepare me for what I went through.
Right. So you weren't very prepared, but you did what most Mormons do and just go.
Yeah. Well, you know, I seem to recall them talking about it all in symbolic terms and talking about kind of Judaism and early biblical things and stuff that were symbolic and had symbolic rituals, and the sacrament was symbolic of, you know, the body and blood of Christ and whatever. And so in a vague way, I kind of thought, oh, so the temple is symbolic. But I knew you wore garments, but I didn't really know anything about them. I did not know. I had no clue that you wore the other funny outfit. I did not know that they did the anointing. I did not know about the new name. I did not know about the 5 points of fellowship. I did not know about... I knew that the rooms were supposedly beautiful, but that was about the limit of what I knew you did in the temple.
So something just occurred to me that I've never asked anybody because I just thought of it now. How do you go buy your temple clothes ahead of time?
Oh, this was why part of why my experience was so traumatic was because all of my relatives were coming. And these were people I really, really loved. And this was back when my relatives were really more connected. So they were coming, and we were doing it in the Provo Temple because the Salt Lake Temple was being remodeled, and the Manti Temple had something going, and we couldn't get in where I really wanted to go. And the Provo Temple's so ugly. You know, it's just it's like a cake with a candle in the middle. It's just ugly. And so I was kind of disappointed because, you know, my dream was kind of shot to hell anyway. And so here I was marrying somebody I didn't really love. I was just kind of, okay, fine. This is my lot in life. I screwed around, got knocked up. So this is what girls that get knocked up deserve, you know? So anyway, I think our temple session was at 9 or 10 o'clock, and we get to Provo and Mom asked me about the garments. And I said, I don't have any garments, Mom. And she said, you didn't buy any? So we had to wait till the garment store opened and go in and fetch some garments. But my relatives had already gotten to the temple and were going through a session.
Waiting.
See, and I thought I was going to my wedding. I didn't know that they broke it up and you just kind of went through this rote thing. And so I thought my relatives are going through a wedding without the bride.
Oh, so you didn't realize that there was like this separate thing that they were doing while they waited.
I had no idea. So okay. I was really confused and discouraged because I thought, so they've started the wedding without me. How sad, you know? So then I get there thinking, you know, my glorious day, I'm going to, you know, march down the aisle and the whole nine yards. It was so not that. And I put on the garments, and this was the first time I'd ever worn them. And I knew my mom had worn them. But
so was this after your anointing that you put them on, or were you trying them on to buy them?
I was putting them on because I assumed that that's what I was supposed to do. So then I put them on and put on this kind of frumpy nightgown temple dress, and my mom comes out and she says, "Dana, I need you to get undressed and put on this poncho thing." And it was kind of a rough, white, almost sackcloth type, you know, nasty looking thing. I thought, what the heck is this for? And she says, don't worry about it. And she just kept patting me on the hand. Don't worry about it. It'll take care of itself. And I was just kind of, you know, on this conveyor belt of, okay, okay, okay. So I put it on. I got naked underneath. And I thought, that is really weird that I am not wearing the garments, you know.
What year did you go through?
83.
Okay, so well before changes.
Yeah.
Okay, so you don't know what's coming up. You're naked. You're...
And then this old lady, they take me in this little, like a voting booth or whatever, and this old lady starts to say her whatever stuff and touch me under this thing across the top of my bosom and low on my belly. And I'm shrinking back. I'm totally uncomfortable with this because I did not know what it was about. And they weren't explaining it to me. They were just doing it because we were already late. And so they were rushing me through this. Mm-hmm. We're walking, we're going, you know, whatever stuff. And I was mortified. I was irritated. I was livid. And I'm not a, you know, low-key person.
Right.
And so we get done with that, and I'm just looking at my mom, and she's patting me on the hand. And my mom knows when, you know, when the line's been crossed, and the line had been crossed there. And it was really awful, and I was very upset. And so then we rushed to the next booth or whatever, a little table or something, and they gave me a new name. And I'm like, what the hell is wrong with my name? I've been this name for my whole life, and I've earned this name. And I didn't know anything about it. Mm-hmm. And in my mind, this whole symbolism thing wasn't entering because I was mostly just blown away by how weird it was. And the name they gave me was Judith. Mm-hmm. Well, at the time, I only knew a few Judiths, and most of them were really obnoxious. Not like me, really sweet and demure and soft-spoken. And I thought, I don't want to be a Judith. Those are bitches, you know? And I didn't know anything about the Bible or Apocrypha or anything. Mm-hmm. And I just didn't want to be a Judith. So I'm sitting there seething after being naked touched by an old lady and then getting a new name that I didn't want. And then we hustle into an endowment session. And some of my relatives had held back and decided to go ahead and do a second endowment session. See, I still didn't know what that was. So they were already in their costumes. And these are people that I really loved and respected. And all of a sudden, I see them in these god-awful, weird outfits. And I kept thinking I was on Candid Camera. That's an old 70s show. Mm-hmm. And that Alan Funt would come from behind the camera and go, ha ha, punked you, you know, you're on Candid Camera. And that look of shock could finally, you know, just leave my face. And
you could laugh and oh, it's been a joke. Oh, God,
thank you. Yeah. You know, silly guys, you really got me good. And I was just really, the longer I was into it, and of course it was the temple, so I knew it was real, but it was so surreal that I just thought, there's no way that this is what I'm supposed to do the rest of my life, and there's no way that I can do this enough to love it. That's like saying, you know, if you just lay back while you're being raped, you'll eventually relax and enjoy it. And I'm quoting a Texas guy there. Anyway, but it was really uncomfortable. And as we're doing it, and then they did the whole Pele Ale thing. And that's when I knew I was in a cult. Mm-hmm. Because they got the people to stand in a circle. And because I was being sealed to my ex. And he was, you know, totally into it because he really likes that kind of stuff. But he was weeping with the spirituality. Mm-hmm. Yeah, and maybe he gets it, you know, but I didn't. And they told us to raise our arm, and this, as we were doing this, and this old guy was kind of, it was kind of like open mic night for old people, and he was just free flowing with bullshit, you know, whatever stuff he was saying, and then we would raise our arms and say, Pele Ale, Pele Ale, Pele Ale. I was freaked out. I was really freaked out, and I was shaking, and I many, many times I kept saying, run, just run out the back door. Mm-hmm. But all my relatives were there. My mama was there, and she just kept patting me on the hand saying, you'll get used to it, you know, and just like, you know, being probed by a alien or whatever, you'll get used to it. You'll just keep doing it, and you'll eventually learn to like it or whatever. And then we went into the 5 points of, or the veil thingy. And they had given me the name Judith, and I was, you know, I was sitting through that endowment session pretty irritated. And we got up to the veil thing, and this old coot guy, whatever, is behind this nylon white curtain. And he reaches through the little hand Vs or whatever they are. And I'm still very weirded out by this. And he's pressing tight against me, and he knows I'm a new bride. And even though I didn't nurse, my breasts were swollen and enormous from, you know, milk or whatever. And anyway, so it wasn't working out there, but I was just leaking out the front of my dress and things were awful. And so he was pressing himself tight against me. And then my ex was standing next to him, and I don't remember how that part goes, but anyway, my ex was supposed to call me through the veil since it was our first time or mm-hmm. whatever. And when they asked me for the new name, you have to reveal your new name. I don't know what came over me, but I lied. I said Ruth, because I knew that Ruth was a nice, sweet lady that everybody loved. You know, she mm-hmm. was from the Bible. She was obedient or whatever. And that's what I, mm-hmm. my alter ego is Ruth. But my real true ego is Judith, a bitch. And she lopped off Holofernes' head with a sword and stuck it in a bag and saved her people.
So are you kind of glad to be a Judith?
Oh, yeah. Now I'm super proud of Judith. But my ex still thinks I'm a Ruth. Mm-hmm. And so in the first resurrection or whenever, you know, that whole stuff is, he'll be calling me from the grave because the church won't let us get divorced, you know. I can be traded up, but I can't be a free agent. Mm-hmm. So he'll be calling out, Ruth, Ruth, and I'll be a Judith, you know.
So did the guy on the other side of the veil, did he know what your name was supposed to be?
I think he was confused, but I think because, you know, they get these older folks that are a little bit on the edge, and he didn't dare challenge it. And so he just kind of, oh, okay, you know. Because mm-hmm. at the time, I didn't know that they gave everybody the same name on that same day, you know. Mm-hmm, so mm-hmm. I could have been a Judith. It could have been a special inspiration from God. Because, you know, he makes stuff up.
So you pull through the veil, you're in the celestial room, and then it's time to go to your ceiling, I guess.
Yeah, yeah. And we were already late. And so maybe a minute and a half in the celestial room of the Provo Temple. Mm-hmm. I just remember it being kind of, you know, like a
white,
fancy living room.
Yeah.
So we rush into the the ceiling room. And
Your son's been in like daycare.
Yeah, yeah. These sweet ladies are taking care of him. And they had just fed him with a bottle. And it was the middle of summer, and so, you know, his little tummy's curdled and everything. They bring him in, they seal us, and the old guy, you know, gives us whatever the rote spiel that they give everybody. And
how long was your wedding ceremony?
Gosh, I would say the wedding ceremony was 20 minutes at the very most.
Okay.
At the very most, mm-hmm. start to finish. Mm-hmm. So it was kind of an afterthought.
Okay. And your son was sealed to you at that time?
Yes.
So he was there with you?
Yeah. And he was just about a 3 or 4 month old baby by then.
Okay. All right. And so did he lay on the altar between you two then?
Boy, I don't remember. Yeah, I just remember the puke. My ex and I were, and my mom, as he's lifting Brian up, we're all going kind of in slow motion. Don't do that. And Brian, just a spew of curdled baby formula down this guy's white suit, you know, mm-hmm. his Colonel Sanders thing. Mm-hmm. And I mean, it stains bright orange. And it was just a exorcist moment, and it was hilarious.
Okay.
But not for him.
Well, of course not. And that happened after.
That kind of symbolizes the whole thing. The orange vomit.
Right.
Curdled orange mm-hmm. vomit.
Okay, so then you're done with the sealing. Your son's thrown up all over the sealer or the mission or the temple president?
I thought he was the temple president, but you know, it's been so long. But I seem to remember that was supposed to be really important, that the temple president was doing the honors.
Okay.
You know, we were just one of, I don't know, God, how knows many couples that day.
So then you're done.
Yeah, then we're done. And so we came home, and that evening we had just kind of a little, you know, reception-y thing, mm-hmm. and a few of my old high school friends came. And, you know, I had this silly little girl fantasy of a nice wedding and everything, and it was none of that. None
so you didn't get it either time then?
Neither time, no. Yeah. No, the first time was prom dress and hurry up because she's going to throw up any minute now, you know, and second time was...
So there was potential puke at both of your weddings
yeah,
then.
Yeah, puke defined that whole first marriage.
Okay. So after you're sealed, you just continue on as a young married couple.
Yeah, and you know, Mom kept inferring that it would get better. It would get better. And my mom's marriage was so horrible. And I'd had it had marriage modeled so badly that I kept kind of using that as a measuring tool. Well, at least he hasn't beat the crap out of me. So he it must be good.
So what do I have to complain about?
Yeah. I'm not barefoot with no gas in the car, and we were poor, but mm-hmm. never even as poor as my mother. And by the time I'd had my last child, I knew that there was no fixing this marriage, that it just, there wasn't money, a new house, a new job, new location could not fix what was wrong between us. We were, sorely intellectually matched, but also I just couldn't stand him. You know, if he would touch me, I would want to wash off that part of my arm where he touched me. And it, when it gets to that point where they say goodbye and or see you later and you mutter under your breath, I hope never to see you again. Mm-hmm. I hope you die. It's time to call it quits because mm-hmm. you already have hurt each other so much by then. And we really, we stuck it out way too long, mm-hmm. way too long. And divorce is terrible, but being badly married is worse for the children and worse for the mm-hmm. couple. And I'm not an advocate of divorce, but I'm not an advocate of sticking it out because you teach your children those bad relationship habits as well.
It's kind of like you're propagating them sticking it out and your grandchildren sticking it out.
And, I think, as LDS women, they kind of are their own worst enemies because they believe that will vindicate them in the end. I have a brother that has been married to a woman and they hate each other, and they've been awful to each other, but they're super proud that they've stuck it out 30 some years. Mm-hmm. And I think 30 years of hell, she's his hair shirt.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't understand why that's admirable over somebody that finally had the courage to kind of know when it was time to move on and change things in life. And I've been much happier since.
I agree. I know more than one person who's in a bad situation who it seems like they think that if I just stay true to my covenants in this life, I'll be happy in eternity.
Yeah, but then you're married to that same person for eternity. Even if eternity is real.
Yeah.
And you already hate them.
Right. It's not like you get to have some different reward in eternity. Your reward in eternity is
it's the eternity same with hell. Them. Yeah. And I just think, oh my gosh, what a sick system, And when we seal, or when LDS people seal these couples, posthumously, whatever, that have no say in it, what if they were just plain miserable and hated each other and death was the only escape
right.
from their miserable marriage, and then the Mormons have gone in and meddled with that? And I would commit murder just to go to hell just so I wouldn't have to do that.
Oh, yeah. I knew a lady... When I was young, I worked at a hospital, and one of the therapists at the hospital had married a good return missionary who beat the tar out of her every day. And she went to her bishop for help, and her bishop told her, "You better figure this out because you're going to be with him in the celestial kingdom."
God.
And she, from that point forward, did everything she could to not be in the celestial kingdom. And it got so bad that she remembers sitting on a bridge with her legs dangling over, completely drunk, out of her mind, thinking, "Well, I'll just go ahead and jump off this bridge now." And it wasn't until she mm-hmm. got help for her addictions that she had developed and realized that the church wasn't true, that she had any sort of peace, mm-hmm. any escape from this idea that...
Well, that's that same mindset that drove that one woman, I can't remember, was it in Washington, that she drowned, threw all her babies off the bridge because she didn't want them to grow up and become adults because she knew that they would sin.
Oh, yeah.
There's several cases of this, whether mm-hmm. it's Mormonism or Christian fundamentalism, it's just pick your poison. All kind of teach a similar.
Yep.
And to the really vulnerable who actually believe this stuff, it's real. And you really are going to go to hell, and you really are going to have a, fiery damnation forever and ever. And so you'll do these insane things to avoid that or...
Mm-hmm.
Or, I don't know, speed it up even. Mm-hmm. It's weird. It's mm-hmm. sad.
Mm-hmm.
It's real sad.
Definitely. So, were you a believer when you got divorced?
No, not at all.
So,
no,
your disaffection...
I think my disaffection started when I was like 9.
Okay.
And you just... Even just a little bit of common sense. Mm-hmm. I mean, even right now, an 8-year-old that can read in 4 minutes could dismantle... the entire premise of the church mm-hmm. on Google. But at 9 years old, even without Google, things just were mm-hmm. obviously I had learned, I think in third grade, they were just teaching tectonic plates and the movement of the earth and mm-hmm. the continents and mm-hmm. stuff, because it was a fairly new concept, even in the early 70s. And so, you know, I'm looking at this big globe and how South America and Africa used to be part of one big continent.
Pangea.
And all that. Yeah, yeah. Gondwana or whatever, all that. And it was fascinating to me, but I thought, I was trying to piece it together with my biblical training and knowledge of Noah's Ark and all that crap. And I thought, oh, well, that's how Noah got all the animals, because we were still one continent. But then, you know, of course, that was gazillions of years ago. And Noah, at best, was, you know, 5,000 years ago. And so none of it made sense. And so I'm, in my mind, I'm trying to make peace with this and blend the two so that I can continue to be a good Mormon. I didn't necessarily fear heaven or hell, or, you know, I never thought I was going to heaven, because I knew I was a bad girl. Mm-hmm. I was just that kind of girl. But I didn't fear hell so much either, because I'd already been there too. Mm-hmm. So I was just trying to get along enough to not be in trouble too much.
Were you going to church?
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, you just didn't believe it anymore.
Yeah.
You just
thought when I got divorced, I had drifted, you know, quite a bit. I was only going maybe twice a month.
Okay. All right. So when did your disaffection start? Like your active searching and deciding?
Yeah. Yeah.
And all that?
I didn't find out all the stuff that I've known since. I left almost solely for cultural reasons. I was probably in my mid-20s when I'd had my last child and had a little bit of time to read again. And I started just reading enough little disconnected pieces of information that I started putting the dots together. And I went back to college when my youngest was 4. And I was taking art history courses mm-hmm. for my degree. And, you know, you kind of go through world history, really, when you study art history. And, you know, it just, all these disconnected things started pulling together, and this picture that was so much grander and more interesting than the limits that you learn from a religious teaching from the Bible or Book of Mormon. And I thought it just allowed me so much more direction to go with my mind, whereas Mormonism kept me in a real small box.
Mm-hmm. Do you want to read your thing now? Do you think that would fit right here? Or
yeah, I'll try not to talk so fast that it's illegible.
Oh, well, you read for the other thing yesterday and you were great. So,
oh, was it good?
Yeah,
okay.
I think you'll be fine.
All right. When I was a little girl, I got burned from playing with matches. My little jumper went up like a ball of gasoline, and I was burned pretty badly on my back, ribs, thighs, and across my scalp and neck. It was pretty traumatic, and I spent some time in the hospital recovering, and while there, my nurse taught me to read, because that was the only thing there was to do when I wasn't sedated or sleeping. So I read and read and read. I fell in love with books and art and illustration, and I knew that when I grew up that books would be a big part of my life. I also began to draw pictures, and I copied what I saw in books as well as tried to illustrate things in my own life. We were very poor by U.S. standards, so getting a box of crayons or other art supplies was a big deal. Often I had to make do with the broken bits and the cheap five and dime store products or the cast-off bits from the school library and classrooms. I still managed to make pretty cool images and art from the limited supplies I had, but I always coveted the big box of crayons that city kids got when school started. I was in my teens and had my own part-time job before I could afford the big box of 64. I was sure that was the pinnacle of freedom and choice. There wasn't anything I couldn't do now that I had a color for everything that came from my imagination. I also grew up LDS. My mother and family and even my children and grandchildren are all still very LDS. Most of them seem to love their church very much. For many people, the LDS church, the culture and history, and the comfort of community is a wonderful, safe place for them. The rules are written and dictated, and they seem to find a lot of security in following those rules. For some, the payoff from strict obedience to all those rules is as they were promised. But for others, there's a lot of struggle to achieve what they are taught as happiness. As a little girl, I grew up believing that the two black and white crayons that I was given as acceptable belief in the LDS Church were all that I should ever need. I was told that if I learned to be satisfied with those two crayons, to shut off the imaginings that there was more to life, to praise and revere the black and white, that I too could have the happiness that was promised to the obedient members of the church. I craved information, adventure, travel, diversity, and especially color in everything I did. I would devour National Geographic magazines, Life magazines, classic as well as the popular youth literature of the day. If there wasn't anything new to read in the house, I'd read the JCPenney catalog or an old newspaper. I'd hide in the cornfield to read. I'd read under the covers till the batteries of the flashlight died, by candle or by the light of the refrigerator if I had to. I read during recess and during class, and if I wasn't reading, I was drawing. As I read things about other people and places and other ways of doing things, I got the sense that my LDS life and the circles were good, but not the only colors in the world. I often felt restrained, like a clown at a funeral, and eventually like I was suffocating. In the LDS church, there's a bucket list set out for every child born from the moment their zygote sprouts a spine. Boys, it's childhood, scouts, young men's, a mission, college, and marriage, and then a family and career, all with endless hours of church service infused into daily life. For little girls, we're conditioned to believe that we'll grow up to be demure, sweet, soft-spoken, virtuous, and pure, and then when we come of age, after high school, we should look for a righteous young man, get married, have babies, spend our lives in service to our families, our homes, our husbands, and our church, and then we die. And if we're really good, we get to rinse and repeat this cycle in heaven for eternity. Who knows all the genetic and psychological factors that go into the development of personality and tendencies toward the rebellious soul? Actually, there's tons of respected scientific data on exactly those things, but that's not where I'm going right now. I was born that rebellious soul. I didn't play with dollies and dream of being a mother. I didn't have the physical beauty or the traits of the precious little girls that seemed to fit so well in the traditional expected roles. I played with matches, ran with scissors, got in trouble for being too curious, too busy, too talkative, too loud, too independent, too excited, too much of everything that was boiling inside of me and wanting an outlet. I envied my brothers and all the scouting adventures they went on while my sisters and I were taught to tat and fold fancy dinner napkins in unique shapes for our future dinner parties. The boys went on 50-mile hikes around Spirit Lake while I learned to walk with a book on my head, my feet out like a duck, my back straight, my boobs forward, except I didn't have any till much later. The boys developed camaraderie among their fellow scouts while I suffered through lessons in cross-stitching. I dreamed of a career as a photojournalist for National Geographic, a reporter for a news station, or maybe an editor for a newspaper. Anything that got me out into the world to meet new people and learn new ideas. As a young teenager, I loved the social connections and the young adult activities. The church was booming in the 70s, and it was a great time to be LDS. They still did road shows, talent shows, fundraisers, and all sorts of social and service projects that kept us connected and involved. I was taught that this is what happiness was, to be a Mormon, to live among Mormons, do Mormon things, have Mormon families, and believe as a Mormon for the rest of my life. I went to college with the intent to break out of that preset box of expectations, but in a rather foolish glut of self-pity, after a breakup with a young man, I hooked up with a guy from California. I got pregnant, and then like a lamb to slaughter, I acquiesced to marriage. You made your bed, now lie in it, was the advice of the day. I slogged along, and I had my children, and in my late 20s, after my last child was born, I began craving to expand my mind. I devoured more books and would occasionally come across a little hint of what people outside Mormonism, that they didn't have the same illusions that I'd grown up with. I started to read little bits of disconnected information that alluded to some very dark things in the history of the church. I was told to put them on a shelf, not to worry my sweet head about such things. "You think too much," I was told. I was told to not look too deeply, to not ask questions, to not challenge authority or tradition, to not peek into the closets or under the rug, and to not make sense of things that were supposedly beyond my limited female mortal mind. In some cases, like when I went through the LDS temple in the early 80s and was so emotionally traumatized and confused by that experience, I started to have panic attacks at the thought of ever stepping foot inside one of those places again. I sought scholarly and wise LDS priesthood leaders to help me understand. Yeah. I was essentially told that such things were beyond my capacity to understand, and to just focus on being a mommy and a wife and all would be well. don't push that button. Don't ask. Don't tell. Don't think. Don't pay attention. Just pay, pray, and obey. Well, the critical thinking skills, the reasoning, even the scientific processes where evidence and testing and retesting, those were not encouraged, especially for women and girls. So I lacked a lot of what I've gained in recent years in my ability to process conflicting information. I tried to make my own theories of how the dinosaurs came about and then mankind, but because I only had two crayons to color that picture, I couldn't even consider the many evidences of evolutionary development and the obvious science on the matter. If it didn't fit what I'd been told was the LDS and Christian concept of creation, then it must not be good or true or even worthy of consideration. I began to have headaches at church, or when I'd try to reconcile my newfound information with the doctrine and teaching of the church. Pretty soon the headaches turned to near suicidal panic attacks. I would anguish over the cognitive dissonance that came with education and information. Going to church or the temple began to take an enormous toll on my mental health, and there were many, many times when I thought death might be the only way to escape the frustration and the guilt and the all-encompassing panic attacks that came with anticipating church attendance or continuing in my huge lie of a marriage. In addition to a bad marriage, I was also finding that I'd completely grown out of the church of my youth. But because I was conditioned to believe that this was the one and only way to happiness, and anything else would only bring sadness and misery, I didn't even dare imagine my life outside the church. I was told that I would not have any moral compass or social support. I was told that I would not be worthy or capable of raising my own children. The threats and the warnings were ominous and frightening, and they paralyzed me for a decade before I could not stand to be in my marriage or the church even one more year, not even a month longer. I thought of suicide 5 times a day at the end, and I planned it, and I contemplated it, and I contemplated the consequences, and I just thought it would be easier than divorce. And little did I know, that's true. I thought I had things fairly well planned for my escape, but I underestimated the control and the power of my church and that my ex-husband that they had. So when I leapt free, I landed really hard, pretty much flat on my face. I lost the respect of my children, the support of my family, the connection to my ward, and even some of my own self-respect. I made every typical foolish mistake and choice, and I paid the awful consequences. I became that cautionary tale of what happens when people leave the church. I experimented, and I floundered, and I failed again, and then, within a fairly short time, I started to repair the damage and restore the relationship with my children. I rode out that awful rocky storm of public shunning and the rumor that came from my little town. I put my head low and just pushed forward and lived really privately and really quietly, trying to get myself back on track without the hand of the church or my family dictating my choices. And it was really hard, and I lost almost everything at first. Then I found that all the reading, all that discovery and curiosity had actually prepared me for a wonderful new life. I started to see things that had always been there but had remained as disconnected dots in space. Suddenly, when I cast off the limitation of my religious and traditional ways of doing things or believing, I could open my mind to thousands of other ways of learning about this amazing world. The cognitive dissonance left my mind. The panic attacks stopped. My suicidal depression lifted, and I found that I was almost being reborn as who I should have been all along, but it had been suppressed right into nothingness. It was like that moment in Shawshank Redemption when Tim Robbins comes out of the sewer after being wrongfully incarcerated for over a decade. I was free. I was emancipated like a 1,000-pound anvil had been lifted from my shoulders. 5 years after my divorce, I met my incredible, godless, heathen, atheist, motorcycle-riding, liberal, hippie guitar-playing, woodworking, anal-retentive wonder of a man, and I soon nicknamed him Bab for Badass Brave Bill. We broke all sorts of rules to be together. Marrying him has been the most incredible and wonderful thing I've ever done in my life, next to the joy of having my 3 wonderful children. I'm still learning the careful, delicate dance that must be learned in order to maintain peace and openness in my relationships with my LDS children and neighbors. They are very, very good people with very good intentions. I love having them in my life. I have to learn patience, grace, and diplomacy, and even to sequester my own intellectual integrity at times, in order to keep the doors open so that they will be willing to allow me into their lives. The church has conditioned its members to believe that those of us who leave are dangerous and evil, and even possessed by dark spirits for daring to leave. It takes a lot of effort to reflect just the opposite, and to show them, by how we live, that we are not the awful, unhappy people they were told we would become. Sometimes it's a very bitter pill to swallow, especially when you're kept from seeing your own children get married or to be included in some of their life events. But in the end, even with the extortion that the church requires, I will pay that price so that I can have my children in my life. Sometimes when you lose, you win. Love wins. Unlike the LDS Church, my children do not. They do not have to comply with my whims and my wishes to have my unconditional support. Now, 11 years later, I'm incredibly happy with this new life, with my new husband, my home, the lifestyle, and the kinds of amazing and diverse friends that I've made. I can't even imagine ever going back to being a Mormon. I finally acquired the big box of 64 crayons, and my world is no longer black and white. There's so much to learn, so many new people to meet, new experiences to try. There's places I want to go and food I want to taste. No more do I have to try to berate myself for wanting to know more, for discovering something that doesn't perfectly coincide with my former beliefs, or close the doors to information that can make my life more interesting, more colorful and enlightened, because it negates the limits of the legends of the Book of Mormon or Bible. The whole world is in living color now. It's 2012. My name is Insanity, and I'm an emancipated Mormon, and I'm happier than I've ever been in my life.
Well, thank you. Thank you for reading that. I remember reading that on your blog, and I think you express very well what other people have gone through, and not only what they've gone through to leave the church, but the continuing struggle that it will always be for former Mormons. When you recorded with me yesterday to talk about the temple petition and the problem of people being excluded from their children's marriages, and you talked about how you have to play nice and shut up and do all of these things to be allowed into certain relationships.
We'll see after this. Surely the rumor will get around somewhere, but
maybe. But
they actually don't think there's an ex-Mormon community, so
right. But I really appreciate you sharing this, and I'm wondering, before we wrap up, is there anything else that you wanted to talk about? Or
I just want to tell people that even if you lose your home and sometimes your marriage, and for a while, the affection of your children, that you can get it back, and you can get back everything and more than you ever thought you were losing. I asked my son one time when we were having a discussion about the Bible and the literacy of the Bible, and I said, what would you lose if you were to ask the hard questions? And he was so frightened, and he's a super smart guy. And he says, Mom, I'd lose everything. I'd lose everything. And, you know, you do. You lose a lot. I mean, my own LDS family doesn't trust me around children anymore. I'm suddenly a toxic, you know,
thing. You might teach him to swear.
Yeah, well, I swore long before I left the church. I always swore. You know, but when I swore as a Mormon, I was just a, you know.
You were that just
was,
a rebellious Jack Mormon.
I was charming.
Yeah, that's acceptable if you believe.
Yeah, yeah. Now it's a direct threat to the mm-hmm. church. No, the swearing is one thing, but it's sometimes as trivial as sipping coffee in front of a child, and sometimes it's dangerous as presenting, as suggesting that I went to a gay wedding, you know, that suddenly I have a tolerance for, and And it's not suddenly at all. I went, you know, we had gay friends when I was LDS. We had people of every color, race, and religion. But now that I'm not LDS, it's suddenly an attempt to infuse my values on people.
Mm-hmm.
And so you do lose a lot.
You lose credibility.
Yeah. And you lose connection, but you fill those holes with really amazing things. And the kind of people that I have met since leaving the church are friends that are my friends because they like me, not because I'm an assignment, and not because we're serving in a calling together.
Mm-hmm.
They like me. It's hard to believe sometimes. but it changes your world, and the ideas that you can embrace after setting aside that small box of Mormonism. And it might be a foundation. It teaches you some ABCs in certain things, but it shouldn't be the end of where you stop learning.
Mm-hmm.
And I just like to tell people that, you know, many, 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 many other people have leapt and landed on their face and survived, and you will too.
Well, I think that's a good message to close with. Thank you so much for coming on Voices. I really appreciate it.
You're welcome.
And letting go has not been easy. But I don't need you loving me for who you think I should be. No, I'm standing here at the end of who I once was. Not sure yet.
Directing, producing, and editing was done by Heather C., and the theme music was provided by McCall Erickson. Thank you for listening. Mormon Expression Voices is a production of the Whitefields Educational Foundation. Find us on the web at whitefieldseducational.org. The Mormon Expression and Mormon Expression Voices podcasts, as well as other educational initiatives, are made possible by your generous donations. Please consider a subscription today.